From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Yossi Beilin talks about negotiating secret Middle East peace talks and why he hasn't given up on peace. He co-wrote the Geneva Initiative, an unofficial peace plan negotiated by a group of Israelis and Palestinians. He was also an architect of the 1993 Oslo Peace Agreement, which was signed on the White House lawn. He now heads Israel's Social Democratic Party. His new book is called The Path to Geneva, The Quest for a Permanent Agreement, 1996 to 2004. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new Loretta Lynn album, produced by Jack White of the White Stripes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The commission investigating the 9/11 terror attack says that civilian and military aviation officials responded slowly to the hijackings and were confused about what was going on in the air. The report also found that passengers aboard one aircraft probably prevented a fourth catastrophe. NPR's Eric Kneeler has more.
The new report focused on military and civilian response to the hijackings. It found confusion among agencies, poor communication, and the fact that military pilots scrambled to protect Washington were not given the proper orders or location of the doomed aircraft. The commission also played recordings of one hijacker shortly after taking over American Flight 11 from Boston.
Nobody moved. Everything would be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll injure yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet.
The report said military jets would not have been able to shoot down United Flight 93 before it hit Washington, and that the passengers who attacked the hijackers saved the lives of countless others. Eric Kneeler, NPR News, Washington.
A car bomb killed at least 35 people today in Baghdad and wounded more than 100. The bomb was detonated outside a recruiting center as men lined up for a chance at a job in the new Iraqi security forces. Iraq's new defense minister said his men would conduct a house-to-house search to capture anyone involved in planning the attack. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, who's in Iraq for talks with the Iraqi leadership, said that American troops will continue to back up the new government because, in his words, Iraqi security forces are not ready to assume their job. At least six more people were killed in a car bombing in a village about 50 miles north of the capital. A federal grand jury has indicted a CIA contractor on charges that he beat a prisoner who died in custody in Afghanistan. It's the first time a civilian has been charged with abusing prisoners. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
The contractor's name is David A. Pissarro. According to the Justice Department, Pissarro was engaged in, quote, paramilitary activities for the U.S. military at a base in Afghanistan in June of last year. An Afghani man named Abdul Wali surrendered to U.S. authorities at the base. According to the indictment, Pissarro interrogated Wali about recent rocket attacks on the base, and he beat Wali with a large flashlight. Wali died a day later. The Justice Department relied on the USA Patriot Act for jurisdiction in the case. A provision in the law extends U.S. jurisdiction over crimes committed by or against any U.S. national on property designated for use by the U.S. government. Libby Lewis, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow lost 2 to close at 10,377. The Nasdaq was down 14 to 1983. This is NPR News. The Olympic torch was carried through St. Louis today. St. Louis was the first U.S. city to host the Olympic Games 100 years ago. Kevin Lavery reports from member station KWMU in St. Louis.
Beneath the glittering steel of St. Louis's Gateway Arch, gold medal Olympians Nadia Comaneci and Bart Connor joined hundreds of people to watch actor and comedian Joe Torre, a St. Louis native, begin the Flames relay run throughout the city. In all, the flame will travel through five continents before reaching Athens. The Greek consul general in Chicago, Aliki Haji, honored all the runners.
The Olympic torchbearers reflect what is the best in all of us. We congratulate them because they are carrying not only the Olympic flame, but the Olympic ideal.
The torch next travels to Atlanta, New York, and Montreal before crossing the Atlantic on its way to Athens. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Lavery in St. Louis.
A Muslim cleric from Cleveland, Ohio, was convicted today of immigration violations for lying about his connections to terrorist organizations. Prosecutors said Fawaz Damra, a Palestinian by birth, failed to tell about his connections to several terrorist groups when he applied for American citizenship. Prosecutors said the 41-year-old cleric raised money for the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which has been classified as a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department since 1989. During the trial, jurors saw a video of Damra saying that terrorism is the only path to liberation. An attorney for Damra told jurors that the cleric didn't consider himself a member of the groups, even though he may have supported them. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Charles Schwab, offering investment advice to all investors who need it. Information at schwab.com. Member SIPC, NYSE.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Yossi Beilon has not given up on the idea of a negotiated peace in the Middle East. After Ariel Sharon became prime minister of Israel, after the Second Intifada heated up, when official peace talks were no longer on the immediate agenda, Beilon led unofficial peace talks between a group of Israelis and Palestinians. Those talks resulted in the Geneva Accord, which was unveiled last October. The signers of this document hope that it will be used as a blueprint for a negotiated peace. But Prime Minister Sharon has said if Israel agreed to the Geneva Plan, it would amount to suicide. Yossi Beilon was also one of the architects of the Oslo Accords, which were signed in 1993 at a Washington ceremony where Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands. In 2000, Beilon participated in the Middle East peace talks in Taba. He was born in Israel and has served in several ministerial positions, including Minister of Justice in the Barak government. Beilon has written a new memoir called The Path to Geneva. I asked Beilon how he got together with Yasser Abed Rabo, his Palestinian counterpart in the Geneva talks.
We have met many times, and we were part of the previous negotiations, the official negotiations, including the Taba talks, which were the last attempt of both sides to have an agreement. It was January 2001. Since then, there was never a meeting on the permanent solution between the two sides. Our feeling in Taba, both of us, maybe unlike the feelings of others on both sides, was that we were very, very close to a conclusion, to an agreement, and that because of the circumstances, meaning we were so close to the Israeli elections, it was a matter of a week or two, and because of the political situation, meaning that the Israeli government did not have a majority in the Knesset already, it was impossible to get to an agreement then, but that had we have a little bit more time and better circumstances, it could have happened. And that is why we believe that it was important for us both to try and build two groups and to work on a very detailed plan in order to prove to our both constituencies, to ourselves, and to the world that peace between the two parties was possible and that the general notion which was then developing that because of the Camp David talks and also because of Taba, that at the last moment, one of the parties will run away, either because of Jerusalem or because of the refugees, that it was possible to have a detailed agreement and to cover all the outstanding issues in a positive way, which we did.
Now, when you and Rabo were meeting together, you were not meeting in any official capacity. You were not officially representing the Israelis and the Palestinians. And there were a lot of travel obstacles in place then that made it hard for you to actually get together. Can you talk a little bit about the physical obstacles that you faced in actually meeting and how you circumvented those obstacles?
You know, most of the time, people don't ask these questions. It is obvious for them that there is a paper. Apparently, people who had met each other found their way to each other in a hotel or wherever. This is not a story. But in our case, it was a story because at the beginning, it was possible still for me to get to the Palestinian territories. Later on, there was a decision that nobody, no Israeli, would be permitted there because of security reasons. Now, as a result of it, we had to meet in very strange places, including in the checkpoints. And I remember one day where we had to meet. There were some issues that we had to talk about. We met in the checkpoint, which is a kind of almost no man's land. It was winter, it was raining. In order to talk to each other, we entered a car. It was a car of a TV crew. That the crew volunteered to leave the car in order for us to enter and to talk. And we sat there while it was raining. And people looked at us. And I remember an old lady, an old Palestinian lady, who had to cross the checkpoint from Ramallah to the area of Jerusalem. And she approached us and looked at us through the glass. And when she recognized both of us, she wanted us to open the window, which we did without, of course, knowing what she wanted from us. And she said to us, "Blessed will be the negotiators." And that was a very, very exciting moment that both of us will never forget. But it was just an example for the hardships of these negotiations. It was really crazy when you compare it to other negotiations that we had had just some months beforehand, when we really represented our states, our governments, in nice hotels, in the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, or in Taba, or in other places, to the new situation. It was really day and night, and it was a kind of a challenge for itself every time to meet again. And eventually we found out that it was only possible for us, or almost only possible for us, to meet abroad.
Do you and your Palestinian negotiating partner, Yasser Abed Rabaul, consider yourselves friends? Do you consider yourselves enemies? Do you consider yourselves just doing your best to find some kind of mutual point of agreement? What do you consider your relationship to be?
The answer is more dynamic than static. Mm-hmm. Of course, when we first met years ago, we represented very, very different viewpoints. And we represented two rival peoples. Now, during the years, when we were much more acquainted to each other, when we met the families and we know each other better, we know one's history better, I of course can say that we became more and more friendly. And that happened to the two groups. I mean, it was never only the two of us, only in the beginning, but later on we became about 25 on each side, people who knew each other through very, very strange points in their lives, as a prisoner and the commander of the region who freed him, and things like this. It was a very, very interesting endeavor and an interesting challenge for both parties. And I think that at the end of the day, when we concluded our work in October last year, there were some friendships developed between the two sides. This is, I believe, the natural way of such kind of negotiations, especially, if I may say so, when we were so far from the media, when we did not have to report every day about the development, when it wasn't a kind of a showdown that we had to prove to our constituency that we made some progress and that the other side had to submit to our demands and vice versa. But it was a real attempt to find a mutual solution, a common ground, a common denominator, despite the big differences and the hot debates that we did have between us.
What do you consider to be the greatest breakthrough that you and Rabaul made in the Geneva Initiative?
There were some. The first one was territory. I had always believed that the territory was the key to a solution, and that we have to begin by a map rather than end by a map. And we decided to base our map on the 67 war, meaning the border of before the 67 war. Once we decided that these pre-war borders will be the basis, with mutual changes, with mutual modifications, we actually had an agreement. Now, we debated about the extent of these changes. Eventually, it was really minor. We are speaking about something like 2.3% of the West Bank, which would be annexed to Israel in exchange for the same size of land which would be given to the Palestinians from the current borders of Israel.
And this would this be land on the West Bank that is already occupied by Israeli settlers?
Which will be annexed to Israel in exchange for land which is not in the West Bank and Gaza, but in Israel itself, in the sovereign Israel, which will be handed over to the Palestinians. Mainly, we are speaking about a strip to the east of the Gaza Strip, which will be annexed to Gaza, which apparently is the most densely populated area in the world. Now, once we solved the territorial issue, we had two major issues. One was in Jerusalem, and here mainly the Temple Mount, or what is called by the Palestinians, by the Muslims, Haram al-Sharif. The other one was the issue of the refugees, which is called by the Palestinians the right of return. We had to solve these two major thorny problems, and we solved it in a way of a package, which I believe is the most important part of Geneva. This is the formula. On the one hand, Israel is getting the sovereignty over the Wailing Wall, but giving up on sovereignty on the Temple Mount. And this will be given to the Palestinians. The Palestinians will have the sovereignty on the Temple Mount, which is very, very important for them, and which is a kind of a sacrifice for Israel. On the other hand, the Palestinians agreed that any question of Palestinians, of refugees admitted to Israel, will be decided by Israel, so that Israel will be the sovereign to decide about any entrance of Palestinians to its own soil. This is for them the biggest sacrifice, because it means that there is actually no right of return, because a right of return cannot be limited. And here we are not speaking about returning, we are speaking about admitting Palestinians to Israel, as other countries like the United States might be ready to host Palestinians in the future as part of the solution. Now, a very detailed...
Wait, I'm going to stop you for a second. Now, my understanding is, in terms of the right of return, let's just talk about that for a second, because that has been such a big issue, and I think that has sunk some agreements in the past. My understanding is what you came up with is that there wouldn't really be a right of return, but Israel would financially compensate people whose families became exiles or had to flee after the 48 Arab-Israeli war. What kind of compensation are you talking about? I mean, that's the kind of thing you could talk about for years after agreeing, yep, there'll be compensation. What? what and for who?
We referred in detail to the formula of getting to an agreement about the compensations. We are referring both to compensations for assets of those refugees who owned them before 48 or 49, and for the for compensations which will be given to every refugee's family for the suffering and their loss in the last 56 years. We are referring to something which is not very vague. There are some attempts to quantify the damages, the compensations which they deserve. It was done in the past both by the UN in the 50s and also by Israel. The gaps are not too big. we know more or less what we are speaking about. We are speaking about tens of billions of dollars. And I think that something like this will be possible with the help of the world, but Israel will have to take part in it. We are referring in our initiative to the details of the International Council and the International Foundation, which will deal with these issues of compensation for assets and for the suffering. And we are also referring to the way, how are we going to agree upon the amounts if there are differences, and there will be differences. So it is not just an agreement about principles whereby we say, yes, refugees will get compensations and we go on. It is much, much more detailed than that.
My guest is Yossi Beilin. He was an architect of the unofficial Middle East peace plan, the Geneva Accord, which was unveiled last fall. His new book is called The Path to Geneva. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Yossi Beilin. He was an architect of the Oslo Peace Accords of 1993 and of last year's unofficial peace plan, the Geneva Accord. Say that the agreement that you came up with, the Geneva Initiative, was actually accepted by official channels in Israel and among the Palestinians. Do you think that Hamas and Hezbollah and all the potential suicide bombers would actually honor that agreement?
Well, Hezbollah is playing a very different role. Hezbollah is a Lebanese organization which has something to do with terrorism elsewhere, but this is not the main problem for us. The problem is really Hamas or Islamic Jihad. Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm just listening to what they are saying that the Palestinians should never have an agreement with Israel, that this is forbidden. But if Israel withdraws to the 67 borders, then they will declare ceasefire. They are not interested in the way in which Israel will do that. I believe that Hamas always prefers Israel to do it unilaterally because they understand that if it is done mutually as part of a bilateral agreement, it means that the Palestinians will have to recognize Israel and its right to exist as a Jewish state, which they will never accept, apparently. So what I'm saying is actually twofold. One is that according to whatever they say, they may have a ceasefire then. But there is something which is more important than that, because it is difficult to really trust their own declarations. I would say the following. Hamas and Islamic Jihad are always stronger in a time of conflict and are always weaker in time of peace. I believe that if we have an agreement like the Geneva model or something else, because Geneva, you know, is not neither the Old Testament or the new one, but if we have something like that, then the chance for the Palestinian government or authority to become the most powerful force on the Palestinian side is very, very big. And more people will help such an establishment to prevent Hamas from fulfilling any acts of terrorism. Today, the power of the establishment is much, much weaker, and their arguments are weaker, because they cannot say, let you stop violence and we will have something good, because there is not so much to promise the Palestinians in the horizon. This is why I believe that by getting back to the negotiating table, something which the government of Sharon regretfully has not done since January 2001, it will give hope to the pragmatic camp on the Palestinian side and will make Hamas weaker and weaker. Many less people will have the desire to commit suicide and to kill others if they have hope to build their homes and to become more comfortable and to have some hope for their families and so on and so forth.
But that raises the question, do you think if Israel participated in a kind of, you know, land for peace and a two-state solution agreement that also addressed the right of return issue, do you think that that the Palestinians as a people would actually be willing to recognize Israel's existence? Or do you think that the hatred of Israel and that attacks upon Israel would continue in spite of an agreement?
First of all, in the agreement itself, it must appear, there must be a reference to the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, or the right of the Jewish people to statehood, which appears in Geneva. Now, you are asking me something which is more difficult, whether the Palestinian people will internalize it, comply with it, and so on and so forth.
I guess what I'm asking, too, is if you think that a hatred of Israel kind of surpasses the specific issues, that even if you settle the specific issues, will there be like a larger hatred of Israel that will endure?
There is hatred towards Israel, and it exists in other Arab countries. It exists still in Egypt and in Jordan, and I cannot say that just by signing an agreement, it will disappear. I believe that such an agreement is a sine qua non, is a condition for change of hearts. But the change of hearts doesn't happen with the agreement, and it will be our role, speaking about the peacemakers, about the pragmatic forces, about those who believe in peace, to educate our respective constituencies. It is a lot of work, a lot of work. We will have to fight against incitement. We will have to try and change the curriculum in schools. Not only on the Palestinian side. Of course, there it is much harsher, but also on our side. Sometimes, even without bad intention, you see that there are references which should be omitted. So what I'm saying is that peace and a peace agreement is just the beginning. It is not the end of educating the peoples to change their hearts.
Yossi Beilin's new book is called The Path to Geneva. He now leads Israel's Social Democratic Party. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with Yossi Beilin on negotiating secret Middle East peace talks, and Ken Tucker reviews Loretta Lynn's new album, which was produced by Jack White of the White Stripes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Yossi Beilin, who has been pivotal in several sets of Middle East peace talks. He was an architect of the Oslo Accords, which were signed in Washington in 1993. He participated in the Taba peace talks in 2000. Last year, he and his Palestinian colleague Yasser Abed Rabo unveiled the Geneva Accord, an unofficial peace plan they hope will serve as a blueprint for a negotiated peace. Now, in your memoir, The Path to Geneva, you say that past experience has taught us that one of the most efficient ways to get to the root of a matter and thereby to reach the bottom line was to change roles. Each of us entered the shoes of the other for a short while, presenting his perception and positions as he understood them. What did you learn from that?
I can give you the example. The example was that that Nabil Shahat did not understand, I believe, enough the importance that somebody like me would attribute the importance of the Jewish majority in Israel. He felt that even a Jewish significant minority could have an impact. And he gave me the example of the American Jewry, saying that despite the fact that the American Jewry is such a small segment of the American people, still they are quite significant in the administration, in the media, in business, and so on and so forth. And I said to him, Dr. Shahat, you have to understand this is the whole difference between the United States and Israel. It is not that it is important for us to have some impact on the life of the state where we live. Israel is the only country in the world where Jews are a majority. And it means that the holidays are Jews and the curriculum is Jewish, not necessarily a religious one, but is relating to the Jewish heritage and the Jewish culture. Now, this is the importance of Israel. People who don't accept the idea of a Jewish state, and there are many who don't accept this idea, may not attribute any importance to something like that. But this is the only country whereby we don't live as a minority. And this is why it is so important for us to assure that the borders will be such that we will not be a minority in our own country. Something like this, which I had believed was very, very clear to somebody so knowledgeable like Nabil Shahat, was not exactly the story.
Have you ever asked yourself, and I think this will probably sound like a horrible question to you, but have you ever asked yourself whether a Jewish state makes sense or can really function in an increasingly global world?
This is not a horrible question.
Oh yeah, well, borders are breaking down and countries are becoming more and more multicultural. At least Western countries are becoming more and more multicultural.
It is a legitimate question, and it has been a legitimate question. I live in a world whereby the Jewish state is a fait accompli. I was born in Israel. I never left Israel for more than a week or whatever. The Jewish state for me is part of my world. But I think that one should ask all the legitimate questions in the world, including this one. Now, what I'm saying is the following thing. The Jewish history, the Jewish tradition, told us how difficult it was to be Jewish as a minority, even those who turned their back to religion or even tradition, those who wanted to assimilate into the non-Jewish world, found it very, very difficult. I'm speaking about the past centuries, including the 20th century. Now, there might be a situation in the world which would be very different. A globalization, a process, a world whereby you are a citizen of the world rather than a citizen of your own country. The divisions between us will not be national divisions, but ideological divisions and others. And it might be a nicer world, a better world. But I would not like Israel to be the first in the queue to give up on its nationality. I mean, after the thousands of years of suffering of my people, I think that we would like to see others giving up on its nationalities, and only then Israel might reconsider being a Jewish state. Until then, and I believe that we are still speaking about some centuries, it is important that there will be a Jewish state. And I think that people like me prove that a Jewish state is not a nationalistic state. Zionism was never nationalistic. Zionism stemmed only from the fact that Jews could not live as human beings in Europe. This was the story of Zionism. And I believe that if we are speaking about a Jewish state, which means the state of the Jewish people and of all its citizens, and if we are fighting like hell in order to create a situation whereby every citizen, being Jewish or Arab, who lives in Israel, feels equal to the other, if this is the situation, then we are winning. If, God forbid, the situation is different, if, God forbid, we find ourselves as a minority of Jews dominating a majority of non-Jews, this is the end of Zionism. And those who believe that this is the implementation of their nationalism are wrong.
My guest is Yossi Beilin. He was an architect of the unofficial Middle East peace plan, the Geneva Accord, which was unveiled last fall. His new book is called The Path to Geneva. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Yossi Beilin, who was an architect of the Oslo Peace Accords of 1993 and of last year's unofficial peace plan, the Geneva Accord. Now, there are a lot of people in Israel who feel that there is nobody to negotiate with on the Palestinian side, not Yasser Arafat. I mean, what makes you think that you can have a good negotiating partner?
We cannot choose our partners. We did not choose President Sadat. We did not choose King Hussein. We did not choose President Assad. The Americans never chose Stalin or whoever on the other side. The question is whether we want peace or not. This is the question. When you don't want peace, you can easily say that your partner is not nice. Who has nice partners? You are speaking about the enemy. You are speaking about rivals. You are not speaking about your friends. And that's why I'm saying I'm not defending our partners necessarily. Some of them are nice, some of them are bad, but we have to make peace with them. And we made already peace with people who were dictators, who were far from being nice, but who kept their words. And I believe that in our case, this is the same. We have now a Palestinian prime minister. The Palestinian prime minister was not an idea of Yasser Arafat. It was an idea of Israel. It was an idea of Ariel Sharon, which was implemented by coordination by the Americans and the Europeans and the UN and Russia. Now, there is a prime minister. The first one was Abu Mazen some months ago, and Israel of Sharon did not help him at all. Instead of giving him or releasing to him Palestinian prisoners, it preferred to release these prisoners to Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah. And because he became weaker, he decided to resign. Now there is another prime minister who is a very pragmatic person by the name of Abu Ala. Abu Ala was my partner in Oslo. Now, why not negotiating with him? I mean, you know that in the last 3.5 years, there was no even one meeting of negotiations on the permanent solution. I think that Abu Ala is a very good partner for negotiations. To boycott him is really not only stupid, but inexplicable. Sharon's policy was that one should not negotiate as long as there is terrorism. If this is a policy, which I believe is the wrong policy, because in history it never worked, why is it right to withdraw unilaterally under terrorism, but it is wrong to negotiate under terrorism. And that's why I believe that the question is not necessarily whether our partner is a nice partner or not a nice partner. I can presume that some Palestinians are saying that as long as Sharon is there, it won't be possible to negotiate with Israel. But I'm telling them, Sharon was democratically elected by Israel. Whether you like him or not, he is your partner. And we have to talk to the Palestinian partner without being too choosy. If we are too choosy, if we are waiting for only for the partner which suits us, this partner will never, ever be accepted by the Palestinians themselves.
I'm curious to hear what you think of Ariel Sharon's plan to unilaterally withdraw from Gaza and the security fence that is being built in the West Bank. Do you think that these are heading Israel in the right direction?
I'm afraid not. Speaking about the security fence, it can only be legitimate if it is built on the 67 borders. To build such a wall in the depth of the Palestinian territories, to separate these Palestinians from their work, from their lands, from their hospitals, from their schools, is something which we should not do, and we might pay a very high price for it in the hatred which is increasing on their side because of that. Speaking about the unilateral decision to withdraw from Gaza, I believe that it is only better than remaining in Gaza, and that's why my party will support it. But I think that it is a big mistake, to do something like that unilaterally, rather than to talk to the other side and to agree upon such a withdrawal. I don't understand. It is really inexplicable for me to understand why does the prime minister prefer to withdraw without anything that he can get from the other side, rather than to go back to the negotiating table and to decide upon the modalities of such a withdrawal.
Do you think that living with suicide bombers, which Israel has been faced with a lot of in the past couple of years, is that changing you politically? Is it changing your feelings about how realistic it is to have a negotiated peace?
There is no question.
And I'm wondering if it's making you angrier, too, if it's making it harder for you to negotiate, to talk with the Palestinians who you've worked with for years.
It doesn't make it harder to talk with the same Palestinians with whom we had talked in the past, because they themselves are not part of it. But it makes it much, much more difficult to make peace because people lost trust in peace. And they may portray the whole Palestinian people as potential suicide bombers. It is very difficult for people to differentiate. It is very difficult for them to say, okay, these are the bad Palestinians, so-called, and they are good Palestinians. No. The general feeling is, how can we trust the Palestinians? And that makes the work of somebody like me much, much more difficult. So there is no question that the Second Intifada, which began in the end of September 2000, made it very, very difficult for the peace camp to proceed with the peace process.
You're in a kind of interesting position. You know, after the Geneva Initiative, you and your negotiating partner, Yasser Abed Rabo, agreed with each other, and yet most of your country disagreed with you. So, and I'm sure a lot of Palestinians disagreed with Rabo. So I'm wondering what it's like for you to be in that position of you're able to make an agreement with your Palestinian negotiating partner, but you can't get most Israelis to agree with you.
The big surprise was the other way around. I mean, we got 40%. Now, 40% is more than what the Labour Party, my own Yahad Party, uh-huh, and other leftist parties got in the last elections. To get 40% of the Israeli public opinion supporting Geneva was the biggest surprise of my life, almost. Now, the same number, astonishingly, was given to the supporters of the Palestinians to Geneva, 40%. Now, if this is the situation, if 40% of the two peoples are ready to all these details, including the problematic concessions that we are talking about, getting from 40 to 51 or to 55 or to 60 is not such a hard work. So I must say that I was very encouraged. My original estimation was that we won't get more than 15%. And this is something I shared with my colleagues. And I was really surprised when we got this number. And that is actually my biggest encouragement.
Is the fact that you and Rabo independently, unofficially, negotiated together a sign that you've given up hope on the official representatives of Israel and the Palestinians on official peace talks?
I would say the following. Prime Minister Sharon has his own plan. The plan is to create a small Palestinian state in the Gaza Strip and about 40 or 50% of the West Bank without solving the issue of Jerusalem and of the refugees, believing that in such a way he solves the demographic problem and he defers the solution for many, many years. I believe that such a solution is a very, very dangerous one for the Israeli national interest. I believe that Sharon will never find a Palestinian partner for such a plan. And I believe that people should know that there is an alternative. I did not give up on the Israeli partner or the Palestinian partner. But I'm sure that the current Israeli government is not going to do something like Geneva. Sharon himself said to the New York Times about 2 months ago that he suggested his unilateral withdrawal from Gaza because of the Geneva plan, that he wanted to prevent an implementation of such a plan. And that is why it was so important for us to prove that there is a support for something like that and that our plan can really solve the outstanding problems rather than to retain them, to keep them as kind of hovering clouds over our skies.
Are you involved in any secret negotiations now? Not that you would tell me.
So what would you like me to say to you? No, actually the answer is a negative. What I'm involved with
in that respect
is in preparing the annexes to the Geneva Initiative. It is a lot of work. We would like to prepare annexes. There are 22 issues that we would like to elaborate on, if it is water, the economic relations, mm-hmm. if it is the electromagnetic space, even technical issues. And I hope that it will be possible for us to prepare a much more detailed one than the most detailed plan that has ever been suggested to both sides.
So you're still working on Geneva. You still think that that is a good strategy, and you're still hoping that it is adapted, or that at least it's borrowed from. At least it becomes an inspiration to the larger process.
Undoubtedly, especially, you know, because of one thing which is quite strange. There is no competition in the market. I mean, there is nobody who suggested something which is an alternative to Geneva, a detailed plan with the Palestinians, which is better in his or her eyes. Geneva is the only plan in the market. And I believe that because of that, this is our biggest advantage, that once the parties are ready to renegotiate, they will have it. Whether they like it or not, this will be the only point of reference, as it became the point of reference in the last half a year. We never believed that the Geneva plan would become such an important point of reference in few months, that parliaments in the world will endorse it, like in the Bundestag and now in the French Senate in the near future and in others. And this is a big achievement for us, and we should like to elaborate on it and to give more details to the annexes, which are still to be worked upon.
Well, Yossi Beilon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Yossi Beilon's new book is called The Path to Geneva. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Loretta Lynn's latest CD, which was produced by Jack White of the White Stripes. This is Fresh Air. One of the most talked about albums of the year is Van Leer Rose, the veteran country singer Loretta Lynn's collaboration with Jack White of the rock band The White Stripes as her producer. The project has attracted attention for the unlikeliness of this pairing, the traditional country singer in her late 60s and the indie rock musician in his late 20s. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the resulting album is neither as radical nor as much of a novelty as you might expect.
One of my fondest memories was sitting on my daddy's knee, listening to the stories that he told. He'd pull out that old photograph like a treasured memory from the past and say, "Child, this year's the Van Leer Rose."
Like a remarkable number of veteran country singers, Loretta Lynn's voice has aged extremely well. At age 69, she's fully up to the task of singing with, around, and sometimes against the rock and roll rooted backing that Jack White provides for her on this album. Lynn's Kentucky Holler is both powerful and melodious, as well as intimate and subtle.
I lie here all alone in my bed of memories. I'm dreaming of your sweet kiss. Oh, how you loved on me. I can almost feel you with me here in this blue moonlight. Oh, I miss being Mrs. Tonight. Like so many.
A lot of reviews of Van Leer Rose have made a big deal about how this is the first album of songs, nearly all of which were written by Loretta Lynn. This betrays two things. One, that rock critics still prize authorship as an ultimate sign of integrity, even though many great pop and rock performers, starting with Elvis Presley, didn't write their own material. And two, rock critics obviously don't know about an excellent little album released in 1970 called Loretta Writes 'em and Sings 'em, which you'd think would kind of stand out if you were doing even the slightest bit of research. Anyway, while there are lots of very good songs on this album, they're not any better than some of Lynn's greatest hits in her commercial prime, like Fist City and Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind. One of the new ones that can stand with her best is this tune, Family Tree.
Woman, you don't know me, but you can bet that I know you. Everybody in this whole darn town knows you too. I brought along the woman that's burning down our family tree. No, I didn't.
Loretta Lynn recorded most of her biggest hits with one producer, Owen Bradley, who surrounded her with stripped-down backing that showcased her voice and the lyric. Jack White adds music to Loretta Lynn, grand, ornery guitar intros and codas that help Lynn establish a mood or punctuate the feelings being expressed. Listen to the way White sets up Lynn on this song, Mrs. Leroy Brown. Another terrific thing Jack White does on this album is permit Loretta Lynn to get back in touch with some of her earliest influences, ones that were quickly banned from her 70s recording sessions because they didn't fit the stuff that was most commercial in the country music of the time, like the bluesy tone she slips into so easily on this song.
Have mercy on me, baby. I'm down up on my knees.
feel me, baby. I'll do just as you please. Well, you know that I love you. I put no one else above you. Have mercy on me, baby. Have mercy. Have mercy on me, baby.
Of course, that kind of country blues isn't commercial now either. But all the publicity around this Jack White album has forced country stations that long ago settled for mediocre country acts like Lone Star and Keith Urban to add the title song from this album to their playlists. Whether this record is interpreted mistakenly as a stunt, or more rightly as an homage from a young admirer to an old pro, Van Leer Rose may not be a great album, but it's certainly one of the most varied, surprising, and flat-out enjoyable ones any country artist has attempted in a good long while.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Loretta Lynn's latest album, Van Leer Rose. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shirock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Steve Lacy, one of the most important soprano saxophonists in the history of jazz. He died earlier this month. We'll listen back to a 1997 interview with him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.